UCR podcast.
Now that David Gilmour's tour has officially come to a close, one of the things we love to do is take a look at, to put it in sports terms, at the tail of the tape. If we look at things through the lens of what David Gilmour did with his show set list-wise and production-wise versus what fans saw with his former Pink Floyd bandmate Roger Waters' most recent tour, they were two different experiences. Now, it's Matt Wardlaw. Matthew Wilking is here with me. You crunched the numbers. It's a little bit surprising to me, Matthew, that David and Roger's respective set lists only had two songs in common, but I guess that shows, in one sense, the two different mindsets that we're looking at here. I wondered, like, what did you take away from the experience of analyzing these two tours?
It was fun, and unlike you, I wish I had gotten to see both.
I have young children.
I cannot fly to New York City on a whim like yourself. I always have preferred Roger's stage shows more because they are more highly theatrical. Mm-hmm. And that's just a different piece of cake. I understand that Gilmour is putting the focus on the music and he wants to put his focus on the present. And I certainly respect that. To me, the later Pink Floyd records, Momentary Lapse of Reason, Division Bell, don't merit the same kind of revisiting as the classic 70 ones that Roger Waters does. So I guess that's my bias. That's my take on the subject overall. But it is fascinating how obviously they both had to do the workhorses, the Wish You Were Here and Comfortably
Yeah.
Numb. But even then, Roger, you know, completely changes up the song, turns it into like this gospel-y funeral dirge and strips out the guitar solo, which is, sorry, the most important part of the song to many people.
Yeah, and Gilmour played it pretty straight from his side of things. Like, Great Gig in the Sky was really kind of the song that, like, he kind of almost took the Waters-like approach that you describe with, because it's like the original kind of female vocal in that song this time was split between the four singers that he had on stage behind besides him, and they kind of took, like, at times almost like an a cappella approach to that vocal. They were seated there with Gilmour. You know, the singers were all around a piano. Gilmour was seated next to them. Guy Pratt was on a stand-up bass, you know. So he did kind of a cool, like, stripped-down kind of thing with a couple of songs. But to your point, like, Waters definitely did more of that with his show. And that's one thing that I would not have minded seeing with the Gilmour show is to see Gilmour take some of the stuff, whether it's the classic Pink Floyd stuff or otherwise, and kind of change it up a little bit more.
Right. Although, all credit to him for devoting half of his show to his solo music. That's a bold move for an artist with a following accustomed to hearing the hits.
It was pretty incredible. I wasn't sure how it was going to work on paper, you know, versus what it was going to sound like in the live setting. But as you kind of say, like, he took more of the approach of... He played kind of a lot of the post-Waters stuff, and then he played, as you say, like, all of his new album, and then selected stuff from the album that came before that, Rattle That Lock, along with some stuff from Dark Side of the Moon, and then, of course, the title track to Wish You Were Here. What was really interesting about all that was just how well it all went together. I think part of that speaks to the strength of the new record, but one of the things I really loved as I was watching the show was that we'd gone through a stretch where it's like he did like Great Gig in the Sky, did a song from like Luck and Strange and, you know, a song from Rattle That Lock, and then, you know, did something from the Division Bell. And so four or five song stretch. And the guy that was behind me after those four or five songs just leans over to his buddy and goes, man, if all those songs are from Gilmour's new record, I'm going to have to get that. That new record sounds pretty good. So it really did kind of speak in the moment to how well, like, sitting there, in this case, at Madison Square Garden, how well all the music flowed together, whatever era it was from. And, you know, obviously, like, you've got Gilmour's guitar as, like, the common thread through all of it, but really thematically, and that's kind of, like, the common ground that I saw between what Gilmour did with his show and what Waters has done with his tour stuff historically, is that they're both looking to construct a narrative. Like, Roger has always wanted to use the music as his platform for whatever kind of issues he feels strongly about at, you know, the point that he's mounting the tour. And I think that for David, you know, it's like this new record, Luck and Strange, you know, it kind of deals with, you know, world concerns, mortality. It didn't feel like it was blatantly in your face, but it felt like he had really worked to construct a set list that kind of spoke to those themes and other themes, connecting the dots through 50 years of music. And I was pretty fascinated with how he did it.
It's also funny how they ended up dividing up Dark Side almost like a divorce couple. Gilmour left, he played almost the whole first side. He left out On the Run. And then Waters did the entire second side, and neither of them touched the other side. It's like in the divorce, like, okay, you get side one and I get side two. And some of that makes sense. I mean, Waters is the vocal on money. So that's something Gilmour had stated he was not going to perform live. Makes sense.
100%. I'll tell you the omission that, you know, I really was surprised that was not in Gilmour's set list is, you know, if we talk about how he puts the focus on kind of like the post-Waters years,
yeah.
One thing that was not in the set list and really hasn't been in the set list is he doesn't play Learning to Fly. And it's like, you know, in the tours leading up to this one, it kind of made sense that like maybe he had kind of a little bit of a dividing line between a Pink Floyd show and a David Gilmour solo show. But it's like the way he kind of almost like opened up and, you know, put what I would say is more songs from like the Division Bell into the set list and so on. Like this show to me, even as he was playing the entire solo record, felt like it was more Pink Floyd heavy than what he's done in the past. And so to that end, it was kind of surprising. But it's not surprising. I guess that kind of like what that says to me is it just kind of illustrates that he's not taking the nostalgic trip. And I don't really think Roger is either, but if you were going to accuse David Gilmour of taking the nostalgic path, like, okay, fine. If he's going to avoid some of the water stuff, that's all fine and good. But it's like he also left some of his own, quote unquote, Pink Floyd hits on the sidelines in favor of playing other stuff, which I thought was respectable.
Yeah, it is. It's probably he playing the songs that he actually likes. That's great. He enjoys playing the best. But it shows overall, summing up for me, it just shows how amazing and strong the Pink Floyd catalog is that, yeah, these two tours from the two titans of the band presenting the material in such a different way. And then you could easily make a third concert out of stuff that neither one
Nick
of
Nick Mason.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. We should have talked about his shows are amazing.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's like Nick Mason, Pink Floyd's drummer, for folks who aren't familiar, like he's got his own band, Nick Mason's Saucer Full of Secrets, and that is completely different than what Roger and David have been up to. He focuses more on early Pink Floyd stuff, including the Syd Barrett era of material. So I mentioned that to your overall point,
yeah,
that you have three guys that are taking this entire long legacy of Pink Floyd's music, and they're all three doing something completely different. Just the fact, as you point out in your article, that like there's literally only two songs that were both in Gilmour's set list and Waters' set list, that's pretty incredible.
Never mind that there was probably 12 excellent Pink Floyd tribute bands playing in, you know, theater and upsized venues. You got Brit Floyd, you got the Australian Pink Floyd show, you have our own local Wish You Were Here, who are amazing.
Yep.
It's a remarkable thing. And I can't wait to see what either one of them does next. So,
well, that's what I was going to say, man. Obviously, we know what David has been up to. Do you think we will see further new music from Roger? I mean, obviously, he's had a new record in the works. And as we know, he's got a memoir taking shape. But, you know, it's the waiting game. Do you think we'll see it? And do we need to see it? Do you care?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see it. I think we will. He was playing that new song, The Bar, at the show. In the meantime,
which was good.
I want them to put out a pro, they did the movie theater thing for the This Is Not a Drill tour. But yeah, I want to put it out on home video. I want to be able to watch that more often.
So, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what's nice about where all these guys are at is like the legacy of Pink Floyd is the legacy of Pink Floyd. None of these guys owe us anything further. So it's just kind of fun as fans, I think, to just kind of see, you know, to paraphrase a little bit what you said earlier, to see these guys just kind of like doing what they want to do at this point. They have more than earned that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, getting into the other half of the podcast, we're going to take a listen to a conversation I had with David Gilmour as he was getting ready to put out the Luck and Strange record. And I think it gives some pretty good insight into where he's at creatively. And for fans that are glad that he's back with a new album after nearly a decade, bit of a teaser. He does say he's going to start working on his next record at the beginning of 2025. So we might not have to wait so long for another record, and that would be great news. And with that, we will turn things over. Here is that conversation with David Gilmour on the UCR podcast.
Hi, Matt.
How are you, David?
I'm pretty good, pretty, all things considered.
Where I want to start, like so many of your albums, there are a lot of magical seeds that seem like they helped to form this new record. And I got to hear the bonus tracks. So talking about Luck and Strange, like I wanted to start by talking about the barn jams that happened back in January of 2007. What was kind of the impetus for those original barn jams?
Well, it was really that we were on tour, doing the On an Island tour, and we, when we got to the end of that tour, I was thinking it's kind of feels like it's a waste for these guys who are cooking and hot. You know, they're really, we were really in a groove together, playing really, really well. And so I thought it was a waste not to do something else with that, cohesiveness that we had. So I got the core of the band, you know, Rick, me, Guy, and Steve de Stanislau, to go to my house, into a barn. Of course, there were things that hadn't occurred to me, was that it was January and the barns, the boards don't even meet, and there's howling, icy winds blowing through it, and it's about 5 degrees below zero. But we managed. Anyway, that was the plan. We did that. There are still 30 or 40 other bits of music, but that one was the first morning. That was the first thing we did. I had that little piece of guitar. I just played bang, bang, bang. I was just listening to that happening, listening to myself playing that and thinking, that's quite nice. And they all gradually, one by one, joined in. And then we played it for 20 minutes or whatever it is. And that is the track. That, I mean, you know, obviously we've worked on it a bit. We've added bridges, middle eights, choruses. But no rehearsal, no second take. It is that. That is the take. And they joined in so naturally. Anyway, yeah, that's so that all came out of that moment.
And it's so cool. Like, we're heading towards nearly 20 years when you did that in 2007. Like, what brought you back to that particular piece of music that, as you just laid out, became the initial skeleton for the song on this record?
It's very hard to know or to be able to explain why some pieces of music put their hand up and insist that now is their moment. And I can't explain it, really, because that one, I mean, I had it in that basic form with the choruses and the bridges before I did the Rattle That Lock album. But for some reason, it didn't raise its hand and say, do me. And this time it did. And I work a little bit that way. I have the song called Sings. There's a sample of me, which I recorded me writing the chorus thing for that song in 1997 when my son was two. You can hear him going, sing, daddy, sing. And he's now nearly 30.
Wow.
So, you know, and that was a chorus of a song, and that I tied together with another piece of music that I wrote maybe 6 or 7 years ago. There's a lot of chance and a lot of accidents that happen on the way to this thing creating the form, taking the form that it did.
You said in an interview talking about this record that, as you put it, you've got over 1,000 little tunes and stuff that are all cataloged. When did you first get your arms around getting all that organized, and like, how did you do it? Because that seems like that would have been an interesting process.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've got lots of pieces of music going back into the 80s of this, that, and the other. I've got some whole songs, I've got some newer ones that I've done, and I've got my trusty iPhone. But I have recorded over a thousand tiny bits of something. I mean, it might just be a sound of a bird singing but I haven't actually really been through those yet. But one of these days I will, or I think I will, when I need something. It sounds like a hell of a lot, but to be honest, you play through them and sort of 19 out of 20, you say that can go straight in the bin.
That's fantastic. And you've spoken about the, as you put it, strange avant-garde nature of the choral arrangements on some of this album. And you have always been, in my view, somebody who has often enjoyed going against the grain over the years with your work. And it seems like things like the interesting approach to those choral arrangements on this new album kind of continue that. Like, I love the way something that potentially shouldn't work works when it's in context with the rest of the music.
Well, exactly that. I mean, I can't put it better, really. I mean, that those arrangements are just glorious and are, as you say, very, very unusual. He did these wonderful arrangements, and he did those quite. But before he did recorded the choirs properly, which we did twice, once in a cathedral called Ely Cathedral and once in a studio in London called Angel Studio. But before then, he had recorded a demo version of it, I think him and his girlfriend, and we put it on the track, and we grew to love it so much that in the end, what's on the record is as much his demo of it as it is the actual properly written and recorded choir.
I think there can sometimes be trepidation. It sometimes takes some time before you know what the record is going to be as a whole piece of work. Like, you being somebody who still thinks in terms of the album and what that's going to look like, what's the moment that kind of sticks with you where you really started to see what this record was going to be?
I work all the time a bit, and I'm in my studio and out of my studio, and I'm collating things, but in a fairly haphazard sort of way. But there does come a point where you think, well, we have enough in the can to make a decision and press that button, say, right, now is the go moment, and we are going to now make a plan and get a team together. And because most of the work was, there's quite a lot of work over a few years on this one, where it's just me on my own in the studio room with a Pro Tools system. And we get to a point where there's a decision, and that requires then a whole series of things that affect each other have to be put into place. You have to decide on who you're going to work with, who producer, studios, musicians. You have to also usually decide on, are you going to tour with it and all that sort of thing. So you have to create a whole timeline that involves all of those things, which very quickly becomes a pressure, a time pressure thing as well as all that.
Sometimes it seems like if you have to think about that stuff, that can kind of take you away from the music. But at the same point, it seems like you're pretty good at maybe keeping the two parts separate.
I think I just say, well, we'll think about that. I probably will do a few dates, but now is the time. I'm not very good at multitasking. I just like to, I put all my focus into one thing, and that seems to work for me.
The way you're playing acoustically with the orchestra building up to the solo on Scattered is pretty stunning. Like, it just generally, that made me wonder how you work out your guitar solos. Is there any one way?
No, there's no one way. And there's no, it's not like I sit down with a piece of paper and have that song in its component parts and say, this will happen. I'm afraid I just sort of let it happen. And, you get to that point and I'm holding the nylon string guitar in my hand, and I think, just keep playing. I think that's nice. And it's, I don't know if I should admit to it, but it's a lot more haphazard than you'd imagine. They're just the moments for the different things choose themselves and assert themselves onto you.
You know, you mentioned the sample from Joe and yourself that wound up on this record, and, you and Polly have been collaborating for a long time now. I love that this is the album where it really kind of becomes a family affair with Romani, Gabriel, Charlie, Joe added into the mix in various ways. But you can also apply kind of that family spirit to this record as a whole when it comes to the band as well, I think. Like, what do you think that added to the overall spirit of this record? Because it just seemed like you had some really good karma going with this record.
Yeah, the family thing is one issue, and that really came out of the COVID experience and the locking down, where I was together with my family a lot more, and we and the topics of these pandemic type illnesses that at the beginning we thought were going to be really much more dangerous than they eventually turned out to be. And you know, at the same time, Polly's book Theatre for Dreamers was coming out, and that had to, or the some events that we had booked in for promotion of that, to get that known a little bit in the world, had to be cancelled. So Charlie, our son, that we do some live streams too, and we didn't know what that meant at all, but that's what we did. And you know, it tied in with Polly's lovely book and doing readings from it and answering questions from people online while that was all going on, was me singing a song or two, usually a cover of a Leonard Cohen song, because Leonard appears in Polly's book to some extent. And I had Romany there with us, and she's been learning the harp, playing it kind of beautifully. It turned out that we were doing these songs with Romany singing harmony with me and playing the harp. And that showed me what we could do together, and how the sound of her voice with mine seemed to have something extra to it that is not the usual thing when you get other people singing with you. The Everly Brothers sound pretty good together. Beach Boys. Anyway, there's 100 elements due to the world and time and political situations that led us towards the way this album got made. There's a liberation in there as well, with these live stream things, and my daughter being a part of it. And, you know, Polly's been a part of it for 32 years. We've been getting Charlie in to help write some lyrics, and I just felt liberated from any idea of owing something to my past, so that I could just move forward, do something different. And that led on to finding a new, younger producer who was not tied to any of the old ways of thinking, and in fact had no real idea about Pink Floyd and the Pink Floyd career, or me or my solo career, or anything, any of those things. So a lot of elements from this are just starting from a fresh standpoint that I would describe as being liberated in some way. And that's not to say that I'm not full of pride and joy with all the long career and the things that have happened in the past, but my focus is definitely looking forwards.
It's the combination of things. I love that you got Steve Gadd on this record, but at the same point, as you just mentioned, you had a producer that doesn't have it in his head. Here's what Steve Gadd is supposed to sound like. It's an open canvas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thing about that is that I had, all before I got Charlie Andrew on board, I had already booked Steve Gadd. I had some of these tracks, and I wanted to, so I'd managed to book Steve Gadd, and we had a week booked in Mark Knopfler's studio in London, British Grove. In the meantime, Charlie Andrew came along, and Charlie Andrew is a drummer, so as well as being a producer. And so he was as thrilled with the idea of Steve Gadd as I was. But man, he drove Steve Gadd like a tyrant. Steve Gadd was there from dawn till, you know, 10 at night every day, being pushed to do another take and try another thing and do the tambourine and do this and do that. Fantastic. Thrilling.
As a music fan yourself, like, what do you remember about the moment that Steve Gadd kind of came on your radar as a fan?
It must be Chucky's In Love. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
It's Phil on Chucky's In Love. Now, I think that's the first, but, you know, a lot of Steely Dan, the Paul Simon things, you know. I met Steve Gadd once before with Paul Simon somewhere at a Jules Holland show, I think. Those sort of, you know, the Steve Gadd and Charlie Andrew thing was like a serendipitous addition to everything that that Charlie was a drummer and knew all about Steve Gadd, didn't know anything about me.
You're going to play some shows this fall, as you've mentioned, and of course fans are really excited about that. I guess, what are some of the initial thoughts that are in your head about that right now, as far as, you know, to kind of communicate like what we might expect from those shows?
You know, I haven't really got these shows very well worked out yet. I mean, I've got a very loose list of songs and things that I'm expecting to do, which do include one or two from the 70s, which everyone seems to want to know about. But yeah, it's not, I mean, I'll be doing, I imagine, all of this album at maybe in a couple of chunks or something, but we haven't got it that well. It's not quite clear yet. But a lot of the music will be newer. It will be younger than 50 years old.
It's pretty great that you're going to have the Webb Sisters as part of your touring group. I mean, obviously, as you noted, they've worked with Leonard Cohen, but they also sang with Tom Petty on his last tour. Like, they're just such talented singers.
They're brilliant. They're brilliant. And we actually did a first little rehearsal yesterday with just them and Louise Marshall and me at my house, just to see how things might sound. And it was very, very encouraging.
One area that fans are curious about in your catalog that you don't seem to revisit in the live setting is material from the first two solo records. And it made me wonder how you feel about those records now, because there are things obviously like There's No Way Out of Here that, although you didn't write that as an example, stuff like that still receives a good amount of airplay on radio to this day. So I'm curious how you feel about those first two records, because that's where you began solo-wise.
You know, I love those records, both of those two earlier solo records. I've got nothing whatsoever against them, but I listened to the About Face one, and the sound is dated, but that's not overcomable. But some of the topics that are being discussed are also way out of date. Are there? And some of the themes aren't quite as universal as you might want to be doing today. And I you're right, I haven't played any of them for years, and probably won't this time either. But it's just that thing of they don't sound like me now.
That's been something that's been pretty stunning about listening to this new record, and really like going back to Rattle That Lock and, you know, On an Island and so on, is hearing that journey that you've taken from those first couple records early on to these last three records. Like, you know, what do you see as like your progression?
I just make the record just and I love these last two ones as well as this one. You know, if one has any regrets about them, I might have upped a tempo or two and made them a bit. I think that they're a bit, you know, possibly a bit too gentle at times. I love them. I love the songs.
I think what I found interesting watching the electronic press kit for this new album is how you've got a lot of gear and pedals that are, you know, often always around you, but it doesn't seem, you know, from what I hear, it doesn't seem like you require much to get your sound.
No, I sound like me, and that is a great positive, but it's inescapable. I can't not sound like me. I've always been a bit of an aficionado for pedals, but I don't like to overuse them. It's true. I'm just bang one in when I want a bit more boost or something, you know. Half the ones I don't even know what they are that I'm using, to be honest. I have a great tech guy, Phil Taylor, who looks after all those things for me and says, try this, try this, try this.
One of the other things that people have always loved about your guitar playing is the economy of your approach. I think you were one of the early people who demonstrated that you can express like so much in your playing without using a lot of notes. Like, what was the moment when you realized that yourself, the fact that less can be more?
When I realized that my fingers were just never going to go much faster. You got to find your own path in this thing. I love making music. I love playing guitar, but to me, it's like I'm playing melodies over a bed of something. You know, while it would be nice to occasionally whiz from one slow, delicate melody to another through a flurry of 36 notes in 10 seconds, in 5 seconds. It's just not really quite me. You know, I do wish I could do it a bit better sometimes. Hey, you know.
I think you've done quite well. Well, I love hearing that you've already kind of got the seeds of another record kind of taking shape in your mind somewhere.
Yeah, I have. That's I will definitely be moving on to that in the new year.
Well, I mentioned that electronic press kit, and one of the things is you were talking about making this record, you talk about how you feel that this is the best album that you've made since Dark Side of the Moon. When did you kind of realize that you felt that way about this record?
When it was finished, you know, and we put it all the songs together in the right order and we're listening to them. You know, I down here in the studio, it's an hour and a bit drive from my house. The record takes 45 minutes. So, you know, we listened to it, me and Polly, a lot, and we still haven't stopped. And we're still as thrilled, and I hear new things in it every time I listen to it. I go, how on earth am I hearing new things in it? I fucking made it. Those things, there's a certain sort of overall magic to it. There's a cohesiveness to it, and a new energy in it that I'm very much liking.
Last couple things from my side. You talk about just the different things that you two felt listening to this. And you know what? Like, after listening to this album a number of times, like, I found myself tearing up, like, listening to things like the words on Sings, like one part of the lyrics in particular. And Behind the Kitchen Shelves, Something's Lost There and Out of Sight, Young Loves, Photographs, Growing Old in Black and White. Now, within the song itself, like, there's this idea that maybe we push the news away and just stay inside the safety of the cocoon together. But there's also the unmistakable feelings of mortality that we are all facing at some point. And you've got a lot of emotions inside the songs on this album, and it just seems like it would have been an emotional thing recording some of these songs.
It is. I love that song. I think Polly was worried it was too sweet, but I tell her it's a work of genius. You know, I am so happy with the way that this record has formed itself, with the way Polly has got herself into my brain and obviously hers and created subjects that she writes about so beautifully, so poetically, but so eloquently. And they all tie in together. The subject of each song is not the same as the subject of other songs, but, you know, without, we're not talking concept album here, but we are talking about a cohesion between all the songs that creates something maybe a bit better than all the parts.
Well, David, I think that's a good place to wrap. I really appreciate this record, and I appreciate your time talking about things here.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Have a good one, David.
Okay, you too, Matt.